All right, so welcome back. So as I mentioned, this time of the year we like to do a climate-oriented or environmentally oriented talk or Dharma talk to help, honor Earth Day and remind us of climate change and climate crisis. And so I was asked to do this by the Climate Action Group. So this is a little bit of a shift of gears from what we've been used to with exploring transcendental dependent origination. But I want to try to blend those together so you can see how they really do fit together. Transcendental dependent origination is a process of us really purifying, opening our hearts, clearing our minds, so we move toward awakening, toward this sense of liberation of our minds, our hearts. And there's a process. There's a process of this, beginning with faith, moving from suffering to faith instead of despair and ignorance. From that faith, we move into this quality of this quality of happiness. And then this month, we've been exploring rapture. And so we can see how this context goes. And looking at the last few years, we've talked about dependent origination. We've talked about the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. We've gone through the Paramis. We've gone through dependent origination, the ox herding pictures. So there's all ways to go in a lot of detail of the Dharma. And I love the holographic nature of the Dharma, that any one piece we can look at deeply enough and actually start to see the whole. And sometimes we get a little bit lost in the details. Okay, how do I do wise speech right now? What's wise action? How do I practice the parami of generosity? How do I cultivate happiness? In those contexts as we go along through the month. And there's a wisdom in doing that because it helps us land and focus on a particular topic, so it deepens. There's kind of this reference point or cross-checking or feedback loop. We start to see more and more clearly. And we're transforming our hearts. But sometimes we get so focused on the details that we forget about, oh, there's that. My printer did double siding. Wanted me to conserve paper, I guess. It's like if we went to the forest and we found a tree and we really studied that one tree. We could see the bark and the way it's developed, all the different interactions with other trees and wildlife. We start to see that that one tree becomes this gateway into the whole forest, into really all of nature. And the same thing with our own practice in the Dharma and our own practice in our own very individual minds and hearts, meeting one way of how do I relate to a relationship? How do we relate to a difficulty in my life? How do I relate to physical pain? Those all can become gateways to show all of the Dharma. And sometimes we forget to see the forest itself. We get to forget to see the big picture of things. We get kind of lose the forest for the trees. And so that's what I want to bring in to kind of connect this, is looking really at the big picture. And that's really, we can almost say all of Dharma is about learning to be in right relationship, to be in right relationship with ourselves, with others, and with the world, and with nature. And part of the predicament we're in is that we've lost that right relationship, particularly with nature, but also with each other. We can see that played out in all the conflicts and all the difficulties and pain that we inflict upon each other. So it ultimately points, we could say, to this quality of a right relationship. Now, my wife and I were just in Hawaii. This is our first time to visit. We went to the island of Kauai. And, going to Hawaii, I was a little mixed about it because it is a beautiful place. It's really a paradise. And yet, if you look at the history of it, when Captain Cook visited it for the first time in like the 1700s, I think, there was around, he estimated between 300 to a million Hawaiians there. And then that decimated to only around maybe 8,000 in 1970, of pure-blooded Hawaiians. So the decimation of disease, of culture, of taking away, introducing foreign species, those islands have been really affected by kind of colonialism. And so I was mixed about how to approach that experience. And as we left the plane, the flight attendant talked to us about this word called pono, pono, P-O-N-O, which is really this quality of being in right relationship, in balance with environment. And she talked about it in a way that was very inspiring, you know, and it's especially considering how much that, you know, the white culture has really decimated those islands, but just to have this spirit of let's honor and be care for the land the best we can. The simple things like what kind of sunscreen you use, what kind of choices you make around, you know, bringing foreign plants and animals in. And this quality of pono is points to this right relationship, which resonated to me with the Dharma. That this whole of Dharma, we can get caught in the details and the lists, and how do I practice mindfulness in this way or in that way? But ultimately, it's about freeing our hearts and minds so we're naturally in relationship, in harmony with ourselves, with others, and with nature. So that's what I would like to explore and speak around tonight. So looking at this big picture of how to relate to nature and to ourselves, a lot of it is being able to step back and look at that in a broad way. As Artemis II, as we were aware, you know, just went around the moon. And those pictures, these most recent pictures of seeing the Earth from afar, from this other perspective. Carol Guile, my mom, brought some little pictures for those in the room. You can grab one, and here's a bigger one for those online. If there's some of the earthscapes or the earth rising from that view. And we see the planet from that perspective, all the divisions, all the separation of countries, of states, all those have been washed away. We see it from such a broad perspective. We see the wholeness of that. And so part of it is coming back in the Dharma, is trying to see things as a whole. As Anushka will probably talk about in a couple of days, the sense of separation of self and others, self and nature, it was really the fundamental thing that the Buddha discovered was causing suffering, unnecessary suffering, this added on suffering. That we see life from this place of isolation, of separation. Even if we're very connected to someone, there's still the sense of self and other. There's a sense of taking things personal. There's sense things of protecting myself, protecting my possessions, the greed and hatred and delusion that flow from that. And healing that division, that sense of separation, was a fundamental thing that he discovered. How to no longer see from that limited, self-isolated perspective, but seeing from a place of deep interconnection. So really seeing not from a place of idea or philosophy, but actually seeing it as a reality. And that's what this year is about, is transcendental origination, is pointing toward that process of seeing it in a much more deep and full way, this interconnection, the reality of it. And there's a balance and harmony that comes from that seeing. That we naturally are more attentive, we're naturally more connected. The stewardess was speaking of, or the flight attendant, I should say, speaking of it in terms of this, she actually used the word mindfulness, being mindful of your actions, mindful of how you move through the landscape. And my wife and I were, you know, of course we're tourists, we're strangers to this land with a lot of other tourists around. But we could, you know, feel that there's different ways that tourists were. Some were very obnoxious. They, you know, took up lots of space and kind of oblivious of their impact on each other and on their surroundings. And other people were more quiet and more soft. I could see that as we stayed there for the week, that the relationship changed for myself. We did a lot of snorkeling. And the first time we saw a sea turtle, I was like, and look, there's a sort of sea turtle. But after a while, it was more of just this relationship of seeing it and being with it, and kind of seeing, trying to keep the space around it, not to bother it, but allowing it to come and go, and have that quality of harmony with it versus making this big deal about it. And then seeing other people seeing a turtle for the first time and trying to chase it and, you know, yelling and all that. And so as we start to become more in harmony, we find that quality of relationship grows, this right relationship. And I think we all sense that. When we're in a more peaceful place, in a more calm place, we can relate to life in a very different way. We relate to each other in a maybe more present, sensitive way. There's a way of listening much more deeply, more fully. And then nature is, it opens our door, our eyes that way too, to be able to be open and to receive the beauty of nature. And to understand the impact of our actions. It's very hard as humans to have totally no impact, right? So sometimes there's sensitivity grows and becomes more sensitive. And sometimes we just need to learn and educate ourselves. I was hiking with my wife, Mount Baker Wilderness, and it's a very popular hike. Lots of people, you know, it was amazing how many people were actually doing the right thing, but there was this one group of three who were kind of going off trail a little bit, right? So, you know, I like going off trail, but I also know when to do it and when not to do it. And they're just kind of doing it just for fun, not realizing the impact of their actions on the small plants. Now, I used to be a wilderness ranger, and so I used to actually talk to people about that. And I actually told them that if I was still working, I would give each one of you a ticket for doing that, for breaking, you know, crossing the switchback. And the two women heard that, and they were like, oh, wow. And it's like I could tell that they were willing to understand that something was off with their actions. Well, the guy was kind of in his arrogance, you know, not really listening to that. But that's how we have this choice. We can listen to the feedback of life, the feedback, okay, how are my actions really affecting the nature right around me, the people around me? How is it affecting the greater nature, the greater world? So it starts to bring us back into this right relationship, this right understanding of how we relate to life. And relate to nature. This relationship of sensitivity, of being in connection, being in harmony, being in balance, we start to learn that in a very direct way in our meditation. So tomorrow I'm going to start this intro class, and people come with lots of enthusiasm, and I really appreciate the excitement of that, and they really want to learn to meditate. But they also have to learn how to have that kind of that subtlety, that quietness, that gentleness with themselves, with their practice. And so often we practice and we come in with a lot of self-judgment of how we think we should be in the meditation, how our minds should look, how they should feel. And have you ever sat down and found that your mind isn't completely quiet? You know, there's lots of thoughts. It just kind of keeps on going. And sometimes we get really judgmental about that. Why isn't my mind settling down? Which is, by the way, just more thoughts, right? So are you trying to use thought to get rid of thought? And we get tangled up more and more in this mess. Joseph Goldstein was, in his instructions of meditation yesterday, was talking about this phrase, there is this body, there is a body. If you look at the Satipatthana, there's awareness. There's enough awareness to know that there is a body. And he likes to start off meditations that way, apparently, because instead of jumping on the breath, we actually be aware of this whole. Like instead of jumping on the one tree, we're feeling the whole of the forest. We're feeling the whole of the body. Instead of jumping on this one plot of land, we see the earth from far, from the perspective of the moon. So this broader perspective changes that tension that often comes with trying to meditate well, trying to be focused so much on the breath. So the breath just becomes another thing that's arising in this body. So our meditation actually teaches us a lot about right relationship. And we often learn it by having wrong relationship to things. We try to power through meditation. We try to force ourselves to be present, to have concentration. We beat up ourselves through our judgment, through our ideas how we should and shouldn't be in the meditation. And over time, we start to learn that all that is just added on. All that's needed is simply being aware of what's actually here without adding anything to it. And this naturally puts us in this right relationship, this right quality of connection. There's a harmony that starts to arise from that. So how do we move through nature? This is a beautiful one too. How many times have we gone for a hike or a walk in the woods or walking around Green Lake and you don't even pay attention to what's around you? You're planning the next situation, the next activity, and they're worrying about something. How often do you actually feel the breeze on your face, see the sights in front of you? And this is a quality that we can learn. We can learn how to simply pause and let ourselves open to what's here, actually the presence of nature. Another thing I like to do is be in nature and let nature relax around me so it starts to reveal itself, right? So for nature to relax around me, I have to be still. I have to be quiet physically, but also emotionally, mentally. There's a quiet sense of quieting down. If you ever want to see like an animal or a bird or something clomping around in the woods, it's not going to help you see it, right? You know, some naturalists like to look at it from as we're walking through the woods. It's like there's this whole wave that's moving in front of us, that all the animals are running away from our noise, running away from this foreignness. Right? But if we stop and be still, it starts to relax back in. And we can start to see the movement of the birds, of the animals. So this is this quality of being more in harmony. And I encourage all of us to do that, to develop this relationship with nature. So, you know, nature will be changing as climate change takes effect. But it doesn't mean we can't still be present with it. We can't develop that quality of nourishment, that quality of really receiving it. Now, nature is interesting. We often work on connecting with nature, but if we just do nature by ourselves, if we put our devices away, nature starts to have its own effect. Ajahn Chah, the Thai forest master, would often have Westerners just go have them go sit in the woods for a while, because he knew that the woods would start to work on them. The woods would start to quiet them. This quality of stillness. And this quality of stillness, this is one of those spectrums that keep us separate. It's like if we're not able to be still with ourselves, to be still with the present moment, there's a separation. You know, notice, you know, just sit and notice how quickly does your hand go for your phone, go for your device, to get some stimulation or some interest, but to actually be still with yourself, be still with your surroundings. It starts to recall that right relationship, the right understanding. Now, so often we try to push through things, push through nature, push through life, and that quality of sensitivity is a very different relationship with it. This points to this wrong relationship, which is often fueled by greed and hatred and delusion. And if you look at some of the choices our country has been making around climate change, it's so easy to see that hatred and greed are driving it, and a big helping of delusion, of misunderstanding, and not seeing clearly, or almost aggressive ignorance, if you will. And this is played out modern day in a very pronounced way with withdrawing from some of the Paris Accords, you know, from the choices around fossil fuels. Again, it's all fueled by this quality of greed. We look past our own history for this country. You know, the land here in Seattle there's huge trees that used to live here. There used to be huge forests. And then we came and we clear cut, and then we changed the land. Like downtown, they said it's too steep, so we're going to power wash it down to the ground. We need more land here. We're going to dump land here to fill in things. So really, as humans, we really change a landscape. Of course, back east, there's all the clear cuts that moved across the country. So as humans, we tend to be in wrong relationship with nature, or at least the kind of the European separate quality. And learning how to reestablish that's part of our job as human beings, I feel. It's also part of our natural progression as meditators. As we start to become in balance with ourselves, in harmony with ourselves, that naturally should go outward, should naturally be with our environment. Now, I want to talk a little bit about despair and overwhelm. Because there's a lot of chaos around us. There's a lot of destruction happening, and the effects of that probably will last beyond most of our lives. So how do we work with that? How do we find a sense of balance in the midst of this? Because it's easy to become overwhelmed by it, right? You just talking just about narrowly with climate change, which perhaps has the biggest impact. But there's the wars, there's the effect on immigrants, there's the attacks on the LGBTQ community. There's so many ways we can describe that. But how do we find a place of balance in the midst of all this? How do we find a sense of ease in the midst of all this? Because it doesn't do much good to be out of balance ourselves, because we can easily get out of balance with our worry and our fear, which may be very grounded in what might happen or is happening. But if we lose that sense of balance, we lose our quality of being effective. Look at first responders, they're trained to be calm, to be steady in the midst of an emergency. Because if they lose their head, if they get too frantic, they'll lose their effectiveness. So that's that calmness, that quality of interconnection. Now, it's easier to find balance when the world around us is balanced, right? That's why we often go on our meditative retreat. We take all our phones away, we take our responsibilities away, and all we have is our minds to try to deal with. And that in itself, as those who've done retreats know, that's challenging. You let things start to quiet down and to settle down. But over time, we start to reestablish that balance. It's trickier when the world around us is chaotic. But how do we find that place of ease, that place of balance? And we start in small ways, working with the hindrances when the mind's caught in restlessness and worry, sloth and torpor, wanting, not wanting. And that starts to train that essential level. But I would argue that actually we learn balance really through by being out of balance. We tend to find we find that balance through things being a little chaotic. We learn to have a deeper quality of it, is what I would say. Now, our minds tend to function in the absolute. We hear this word like balance and harmony, and we think, what's the most absolute perfection of that? And if I don't have that, then there's something wrong with me, right? I'm not doing the job well. But that, of course, does that help you be more imbalanced? What if balance was just a relative thing? To how can I be balanced in this moment, given this situation, how things are right now, whether it's something personal, with health crises, with loved ones in the hospital, with friends dying and dead, reading the news, seeing the difficulty and across the world, the fear of climate change, my own physical mortality. Once if that, whatever the situation is, my mission or my task is really to find balance in the midst of that. So for years I used to do the martial art of Aikido. So if you're familiar with it, there's a lot of throwing and falling stuff. So when someone attacks you, you step out of their way, take their own momentum, and help them connect with the ground. Sometimes very dramatically. But by doing that, I would be out of balance a lot because I'd be attacking and I'd lose my balance. But I could still have a sense of harmony, a sense of inner balance, even while I was flying through the air or being flipped through the air. Or if someone pushed on me, I learned if I try to push back, then it would be lost. But if I actually relaxed, centered, I could flow and move with that. The founder of Aikido was named Ueshiba. And there's a little story to share from Fearless Riding by William Kenover. One day, one of Ueshiba's oldest students was watching the master demonstrate technique after technique. Throughout the demonstration, Ueshiba's balance appeared perfect. The student had been observing this since the first day he tried, striving unsuccessfully ever since to emulate the master's apparent perfection. At the end of class, he approached the great teacher. "Sensei," he began, "I have to ask you a question. I've been training and training for years. Every day I train, I'm off balance. Every technique, no matter how rudimentary, I'm always off balance. I watch you train, and you're never off balance. How do you do it?" And Ueshiba said, no, this isn't true. I'm frequently off balance. I'm just very quick to get back on balance." Right? So he loses balance, but very quickly restore it. And through that sense of harmony with the situation that's right there. So we have our personal situation. I'm sitting and mind is busy. There's a sense of unease in the body. How do I find balance in relationship to that? How do I find balance in the relationship to the grief and fear and anger around the climate change? How do I meet that? How do I find that balance? And it's not a static thing. It's not like I'm building a house of cards and everything's perfectly balanced and I can't even breathe on it. It's a much more fluid, robust quality of balance. So as you meditate, start to bring that in, you know, bring that quality, what Joseph talked about, this wholeness of the body. The wholeness allows us to be much more resilient, much more flowing with. Bring that into relationships. How do I regain this balance? How does that balance look like, harmony look like in this moment? Right here in this moment where the conditions are just how they are. And then finally, where is balance found? You know, is it found in the future? Is it found in the past? It's actually found right here in this moment. You're coming back to this moment's experience, this moment's relationship. This moment's relationship shapes the future, right? And this moment has been shaped by the past experiences. So we learn how to be more and more in balance, more and more in harmony. So as we meet this, as we honor Earth in this day and this Earth Day, and we also have this sobering look at the nature of climate change and climate crisis, we still can appreciate the beauty of nature. Appreciate the way it resonates very deeply with ourselves. Opening to nature in a deep way teaches you the Dharma. Ajahn Chah said something like, you know, knowing nature means you know Dharma. Knowing Dharma means you know nature. So giving yourself the gift of being in nature in small ways. You don't have to go someplace exotic like Hawaii. You can go into your back door. You can just find a single tree or a bush and relate to it and be with it and connect how that one tree or bush connects you to this much larger envelope of nature all around us. And that starts to bring us this different sensitivity to our actions, to those small choices. Educate ourselves. How can I live in a more light way? How can I have less impact? How can I bring that quality of pono, of harmony, of balance, of care to everything I do? In this small way, your individual actions start to add up. They start to change this momentum that we're having. So let's sit quietly for a couple of moments, just letting those words settle. And then we'll open to any questions. So if you have any questions about the talk or about anything in the Dharma, I'd be happy to try to engage around it. So those in the room, you can raise your hand. We'll bring the mic over so we can have the interface for online and in person. Online, you can just raise your virtual hand and I'll call on you. Okay, go ahead, Iris.
Thank you, Tim.
Just a second. We got you a little muted. Try it again.
Can you hear me?
Yep, you're good.
Great. I want to thank you so much for this beautiful talk, and I just love the frame around right relationship. It was just perfect. So I just want to deeply thank you for this frame. Thank you.
You're very, very welcome, Iris. So those of you who may not be aware, Iris is one of the leaders of the Climate Action Group. And so if you're interested in getting engaged around like-minded people, and there's information on the website around that group, and Walk for Peace will be also part of that. So thank you, Iris, for all your work you do, and Ken and Carol and all the other people who participate in that group. All right, go ahead, Jeremy.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, you're good.
Great. I'm curious about your thoughts on, you've drawn this connection between these sort of senses of place and peace and the sort of like philosophies of climate activism and things like this. This might be a good question for the Climate Action Group, which I haven't participated in yet, but I'm curious what you feel is like the Dharma's perspective on action itself. Because often things like climate action might begin with sort of like philosophical things, understanding our place in nature, that we are not above it, things like that. But it also demands like pretty serious action and change and sort of fighting, which are things that I think typically we might not associate with like meditative practice. And so I know Buddhism does have, being spread across the entire world has not just a history of politics and political activism, but multiple histories of political activism. But I'm curious, what is that connect? Like, what is that Dharma perspective on political action when often action often comes from a place of like not being at peace and like needing to really act out some like I guess a desire in a way, like an intense need to fix something. So what should our perspective be on things like that if we can always just return to our breath and sort of ignore how messed up the world is, or just accept how messed up the world is and move past it. What's the perspective on actual political action, and what drives someone to actually do that from a place of peace?
Yes, thank you for that question. Yeah, it's a very common question around, you know, the relationship between our kind of receptive, passive practice and action. What's wise action? And it's often it shows up in different ways, and this is, you know, different ways this shows up, but this is a really important one. And I would say that there's a couple pieces around that, and I don't want to lose those thoughts. First one is that it's really a fallacy that our meditation practice is designed to be passive, right? It's about meeting this moment as fully and completely as we can, clearing our distortion of this moment, right? So we'll practice that. We'll have to learn it by being more receptive. Because so busy, we're so busy acting usually, so busy reacting to things, we don't really connect with this moment. Now, once we learn to really connect with this moment, from that point, action naturally flows forth. Action naturally flows forth from a more clear way, a more open-hearted way, a more powerful way, I would say. And you see this for yourself. If someone is kind of running around doing all this stuff, they're not very effective. But someone who is clear in themselves, they do an action and there's not much distortion. There's not much ineffectiveness in it. It's very effective. Now you look at the Eightfold Path, one of the fundamental pieces of the Dharma, of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. The whole three mental aspects is really around wise action, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. So even the Buddha really spoke of it from that perspective. It's not just meditation, it's meditation and how do we act in a wise, powerful way. So that piece is, you know, I think it's very common for people to feel like I'm just so passive, but we're confusing the sense of how do I practice being with myself in the moment and realizing from that point of contact, from there I act out. That's when my actions flow from. Now, the other part of the question that I wanted to get to, and this is in some ways more interesting, and that's around what motivates our activism, what motivates our engagement. So before we practice, that action may be coming from a place of rage, of anger, of hatred even. You know, I think that's probably true. There's a lot of hatred that comes forth that motivates our actions, you know, especially in a political realm or the activism. And those can definitely give very powerful actions. But I would say that because there's the hatred in that or that sense of outrage, maybe not outrage, but let's say the hatred. So I like to distinguish between anger and hatred. Because anger is this natural part of being human. I can be angry about being transgressed against, about boundaries being crossed, around seeing harm in others. But the hatred is when I start to, my heart starts to harden to someone. It starts to close them out, right? And that starts to go into that separation. While anger itself can be a powerful way of acting without having the separation. Now, if you start to practice, that hatred starts to lose its grip. It starts to make less and less sense. That sense of separation between self and other, right? Because the other, we especially search throughout the world politics, there's a lot of othering happening, right? There's a division, a deep schism. Right? And we can feel very justified in our position. The other side can feel very justified in their position. I don't see that's going to heal things. But there's a way that our actions become very transformed when we start to lose that inner separation, but we're able to still stand up for what feels right, what we know is actually true. And then our actions have a different quality to them, that we can still loudly say no, we can say this is not right, this is not okay, but there's not this sense of demonizing, and not this quality of deep separation that's fueling that. So in that way, it does really transform our actions and our political engagement. Is that anything else follow up on that, Jeremy, or is that good?
Yeah, I think that answers my questions and also kind of helps solidify some of the similar thoughts I've been having. It makes me also think of the the term radical in the sense of a root. I feel like meditation can be very good at helping people identify the roots of problems and
That's
therefore
right.
act more directly.
That's right.
Which is how I see the word radical. So yeah, thanks for that.
Yeah, seeing the root is so key. All right, I'll come back to you in a second, Lauren. Let me just pause and see if there's anyone here in the room. All right, if you have something comes up, let me know. Okay, go ahead, Lauren.
Thank you, and thank you for your talk this evening, Tim. I also really liked the concept of right relationship as being a main theme for our relationship with nature and climate and
yes
human power and so forth. And also I like that you pointed out the sense of separation of self and other is the key problem that the Buddha identified. And that's why, you know, we work so hard, or we try to understand anatta, to, you know, not self. And that seems to be a real, really important aspiration, and how that works into connection with nature and disconnection with nature and harmony. So those themes to me just are really the heart of the issue that we're dealing with nature. And when Jeremy brought up the activism, it made me think of the story of Angulimala, because I've always loved that story, because the Buddha, Angulimala was a serial murderer. Some of you may know the story. And he wore a necklace of fingers, I think, of his victims. So he was someone that one could really hate. And the community told Buddha not to go out in the forest, because Angulimala was out there and he would kill him. But the Buddha just decided, no, I'm going on my walk. And it was a very steady pace of his walk out into the neighborhood where Angulimala was looking for victims. And sure enough, Angulimala saw him and told him to stop. And the Buddha just kept his regular pace. So there was no reaction in the Buddha. There was no hatred, just the things you were talking about. And then, as I remember it, Angulimala could not catch up with the Buddha, no matter how, every time he would go forward trying to get to him, the Buddha was always ahead of him. And so he said, stop. He wanted the Buddha to stop. And the Buddha turned and said, no, I've stopped. You stop. And that was it. Just stop. And so my feeling is that what we do as activists. We stand, and like things that happened at Minneapolis, people just stood there and said, stop. And that has more power. And like you're a keto, I took a keto for a few months. And I remember, practicing that it wasn't it wasn't this kind of combat. It was kind of this kind. So we're talking about harmony and unity, because you're still in relationship with your enemy. And we really, we want to relate to the earth. We want people to be aware of it. So we can't be hating and separating ourselves from those who we think are not. But we can, in strength, stand up and say, no, I've stopped, you stop. So I just wanted to share that.
Thank you, Lauren. I appreciate that. You're also part of the Climate Action Group, right?
Yes.
Yep, another active member in it. Yeah, so that's kind of the discussions that they have around, how do we, as Dharma practitioners, engage with something that's so vital, that's so important. So if you're drawn to that, reach out and meet with them. Yeah, that sense of how do we say, sometimes our very presence delivers a different message, a much stronger message than our words ever can. All right, anyone else? Yes, someone made a note about the just the impact of traveling, the emissions by taking the flights. Yeah, it's so hard to have no impact. Sometimes Dharma teachers, we talk about that, should I travel to teach a retreat? What's the pros and cons of all that? So it's being conscious of the impacts. I think that's a piece of it, is we talk about meditation and how we have that moment by moment relationship to things and how that clarity grows. But there's also a big place for having understanding, having no more knowledge. Like, what actually is the impact of the choices that I make? The choices of travel, the choices of vacation. All right, so go ahead. Is it Kamal? Where did you go?
Yes, yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yeah, just kind of continuing on with the conversation we've been having. There's this moment, I guess, I'm trying to understand, or just maybe get reflections. You know, when you have a difficult decision to make, or when you are in a challenging moment and you're trying to be in presence and, you know, trying to not be reactive. I'm curious, you know, like what that moment when you have to make that decision of to say something or to send an email or whatever it might be. How should we, or how may we, sit with presence as we're making those decisions?
Mm-hmm.
How does that show up?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's kind of my comments about how we tend to be kind of absolute in our thinking. I have to be like 100% present, or if I'm not that way, I'm failed completely. Is actually, if you pay attention, just a little bit of presence, just a little bit of awareness of yourself, of your experience, it actually transforms things a lot. You know, when we get caught in reactivity, caught in anger, we lose that perspective. We're just 100% in it. We're just reacting. You know, we're saying things that we regret later on. But if I can pause for just even a few seconds, if I can just feel my feet, if I can maybe have 10% of my awareness in my body, that often gives us enough clarity to say things a little bit differently, or even to realize, like I happen to do this with when I'm upset about some interaction or some email or some argument, I recognize that I'm not clear right now. And so I'm not going to keep on speaking because I know I'm going to cause mess in myself and others. So I say, can I come back to you? I need a little bit of space. So think of it that way, that just having a little bit of attention reserved into your body, feel maybe your feet, feeling your breath, maybe being aware of something outside of this person or this email screen that you're, or computer screen that you're staring at. Notice the movement of the breeze through the leaves. Feel it, open to those other senses. That just that little bit doesn't feel like it's very much compared to how much reactivity is, but yet it does start to call forth these wiser parts in us, these more compassionate parts in us. And so try it out. I mean, that's where it really, it shows up. The more confident, and you get more confidence in that, you start to trust that. And that's probably one of the more significant hurdles is we're so bought into our reactivity and what our minds say that I have to just follow that. To actually trust that, actually pausing for a few seconds, feeling my breath, actually allows me to be much more effective, skillful, and compassionate, and more harmonious. And the other part of it is when we're not perfect in that, we're able to repair more easily. We're able to really hear the impact of our actions. And that's probably, if I'm honest, that's probably the biggest part, is the willingness to hear other people's perspective. Okay, when I said this, what was that? How did that feel to you? Okay, I can own my own reactivities. Like, yeah, I was really angry. I was hurt. My words got distorted. I'm sorry. There was that impact. And so that's why this sense of relationship is such a beautiful way of approaching it. It's not like this static meeting. It's this constant dance. And over time, as we move together through this world.
Thank you. That really resonates.
Thank you for your question. All right. We have two online in the room. We'll get to you second because she's right there.
So just kind of following up on that, I'm curious about like how you would feel about, like, should you go searching for, like, do I feel aversion? Do I feel contracted? Mm-hmm. Like,
in the midst of like a conflict?
Yeah. Like just kind of that instead of feeling your feet.
Yeah. There's different kind of entry points And so like, yeah, we could probably do a whole year or month long talking about all those points. I think, you know, feeling the feet, I kind of see it almost as a progression, if you will. Because if I can't feel my feet or have some relationship to something that's outside of the charge, it's kind of hopeless, right? Because I'm so caught in it. But if I have like 10%, okay, I can feel my feet, then that allows me to ask kind of like that secondary question. Okay, what's really the hook here, if you want to go in a psychological perspective? From a Buddhist perspective, yeah, is this aversion? Is this craving? Is this wanting? You know, what's kind of the flavor of it? Even like the Vedana is a very powerful thing. Is this pleasant or unpleasant? I mean, of course it's unpleasant, but oh yeah, just to acknowledge, oh yeah, this is an unpleasant moment, right? That in itself, it's like we're stepping back enough to observe from that place of observation, then we re-engage through action. But I think something to kind of move us out of that lockstep, how we just kind of lock in and we get lose all perspective. Oh, there's the feet. There's the breath. Oh, there's the tree or there's the moon in the sky. That little bit of broadening my perspective allows me to start to bring some of those deeper skills in, like, yeah, like kind of what's an inquiry question, kind of what's the heart of that. I think that's ultimately what I found helpful is to find what's the heart of this conflict. Like, not so much these days, but for years, my wife and I would get in some kind of conflict and get, you know, short words with each other. And it would be usually around something like, you know, I've done the dishes more than you have, or no, I've done it more. You know, there's that kind of thing. And we just argue back and forth. But like, okay, it's really about being maybe appreciated or being seen. Or maybe this is a placeholder for how I was raised and kind of relationship to cleaning the kitchen when I was, you know, a kid. It's like, since you start to see that, oh, this conflict is much deeper. And the more we get used to doing that, the more we start to not be so convinced by the display of our mind, how convincing it can be. Yes, so
thanks again for the great Dharma talk again, Tim. I really like the analogy, I guess, or I don't know if analogy is the right word, but sort of thinking about that we're kind of stuck on one tree in a big forest, or I don't know if that was the exact way it was framed, but I was kind of thinking about like the way sometimes I also have like see my, you know, interaction with other people, right? Sometimes I get into like kind of like what the previous people have been discussing, kind of like, you know, adversarial interactions with people, and made me kind of not really, you know, just maybe like distrust a certain, you know, like, you know, kind of like it kind of gives me an impression of people that, you know, would like make me not feel like talking to this type of person or this type of person, you know, mm-hmm. I don't know if like maybe just like I want to say maybe just like categorizing a broad group of people of just like I don't want to talk to these sort of I don't know if there's like a way to sort of see through it as well, like kind of sure. See the whole forest, I guess, in terms of like these people to people interactions.
Yeah That's I think that's a really important thing that you're pointing toward, is that we see a kind of a category of people and we just relate to them from the category in our minds versus the actual people. You know, we could pull whatever, you know, feels completely opposite of your beliefs, you know, whatever category of being that might be, we could pop them in this room, we actually listen to them and connect it, we could actually see there's all these nuances and all these intricacies of that. And this is actually a really important Dharma point, that we see usually through our preconception, pre-idea. You know, like we already decided who and what this person is. This is a root of prejudice or racism, any of the isms. We see through that versus actually who they are. And we do that all the way. We can do it academically. We can do it in different fields, different political spectrums, religious beliefs, whatever it might be. But actually be able to connect and see through that. So the way to practice it, I like to practice it, kind of get a simple way that's not charged. And I like to, going back to nature, well, look at a tree And notice what your opinions are over that tree, right? I like that tree. It's beautiful. Maybe I know it's the species. But notice how those are ideas that you've planted on the tree. And start to peel back to say, okay, what's the tree before I came around? Before I had an idea of what this tree is, let the tree speak. Let the tree present itself. And that's really the heart of that, is you peel back your layers to actually see the essence of another person. You know, so practicing in that simple way, you kind of get the knack of it. But you have to practice it it's not really a high stakes, but you have to practice it with people. So here's your challenge is, next time you have one of those people that you've put in a category, intentionally go and have a conversation with them. You know, maybe don't talk about the most charged division between you, but talk about, wow, do you think it's the weather is ever going to stop raining, or, you know, something like that? Or how do you think the Mariners, whatever you find a connection.
So it's something like simple, right? Like
something
neutral.
Simple. Yeah.
And try to connect with them in that way.
Yes. And then while you're doing that, you're paying attention to yourself as well. You're sensing them, you're connecting with them, but you're also monitoring yourself. You notice, oh, there's that tension around they're saying that thing, and or I'm getting tired, or I don't want to be here. All that, that's, meditation's not about being aware of the breath. Mm-hmm. That's how we train ourselves. Meditation is about learning to be aware of this whole gestalt of humanness. Being present for it, being aware for it, then we're able to have better and better choices.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thanks for your question. All right. Anyone else? We have a few more minutes. All right. Leslie.
I just had some thoughts of the don't know mind being really important in that situation of, you know, and also how do I approach action from a point of no self? And if you have ideas or thoughts about that, maybe that's exactly what we're talking about here, but, you know, your feedback is great.
Yeah. So the not knowing mind is, I think a Korean Zen phrase, but it's really a powerful phrase, is that sense of knowing creates that sense of separation, that distance. It really activates a sense of me and other, right? Sometimes it's, you know, it's a lovely connection. It's okay, I like you. But there's still this sense of we, like, our minds like to put everything in its place. In our history, we do that through trauma, right? There's traumatic pieces that come up. There's pleasant experiences. There's anticipation. There's all these pieces. But that's all the way the mind's knowing the thing. We need to peel back those layers, then there's the not knowing. In the not knowing, we also have to not know ourselves. What I mean by that is, this is a paradox because the words don't make sense if you actually look at the experience. We actually know ourselves in a very deep way. We're just not putting a label on it. We're not making a conclusion on it. That's right. Yeah, let's imagine there's a river flowing by. I'm not taking a cup of water and saying, this is the river. I'm realizing the river is this constantly moving, changing thing. Right, so that's that. What do you mean by ourselves have to have that not knowing of ourselves too? And yet we're knowing outside of thought, we're knowing outside of idea, right? So in terms of how to action comes from a place of non-self. This is a much more in some ways it's a very. It's the crux of, I think, why it keeps a lot of us kind of stuck in self, because we can't imagine how would I go through the world without the self being in charge. But once you really deeply understand non-self, not as an idea, but as a direct seeing, the question falls away. So it's like the mind's like, I don't know how I'm going to do this. You know, I don't know how I'm going to navigate. How am I going to be... But once you see through the self, it's like you just do it. But something else is motivating you. It's compassion in a pure way. It's kindness in a pure way. It's wisdom in a pure way. versus, you know, that sense of I want to be seen, I want to be better, I want to prove them wrong, I want to decimate them. You know, pick your favorite politician, how they speak about their enemies. It's often a very sense of you know, the sense of self is really strong in there, right? And other is very strong. But from the really from the reality of this non-self, the question and problem goes away. So I'm just saying that to just kind of relax, everybody relax about it.
It's trying to understand that concept with your mind, which doesn't, I mean, that's what I'm doing, I think, is like trying to think about non-self, which really just reinforces self. So it's like, okay, stop, just leave it alone. Felt sense.
That's yeah. Right. Yeah. Everybody does that. Probably right. Almost everybody does that. Because that's what we know how to do, right? That's helped us plan dinners, helped us drive here, it's helped us, you know, do all these things. But there's so you do it enough, but be willing to get really frustrated with that. Tendency.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To the point you really let go of it.
Sounds good. Thank you.
So something else comes forth. And it's much more of a process of subtraction than addition. Right? So it's not like we're gaining something. We're just revealing what's already here. All right. Anyone else before we close? All right. Well, thank you all for your questions and engagement around it. It's like your questions, you know, having the courage to ask. I know it's sometimes hard to ask a question, but it really helps to flesh out the topic and the Dharma, and your question resonates with more people than you would realize. So thank you for all your questions and engagement. And next week we have Tuareg Salah will be here, and the week after that too. So we'll be going back into the transcendental origination with this interesting topic of rapture or pitta.